Good morning.
Good morning.
It is so good to be with you here today and feel your warm welcome. I was here about a year ago and preached on Adam Smith as the first moral economist. Now today, I'm doing something completely different based on your worship and community theme. In keeping with that theme of place, I'm speaking today of sacred place. What does it mean to say that a place is sacred? In what ways is that sacredness expressed to us? What do sacred places even look like? I was raised in Richmond, Virginia, on the south side of the James River, which really matters in Richmond. Our first house there was in a neighborhood very near to the river. And an early memory of mine is walking with my mother to a nearby small park named Wayside Spring when I was probably about 4 years old. Wayside Spring was built by Civilian Conservation Corps workers in the 1930s, as were many of Richmond's iconic parks. And you'll notice the beautiful gray stonework and the heavy iron chain. Those are very common in those parks in Richmond. And Wayside Spring is a very small park. It is in an ordinary city neighborhood where there are single-family houses, and the whole park, as it fronts on the street, is maybe only 2 or 3 house plots wide. And it is this steep, narrow gorge filled with greenness. To the left of what you just saw are steep, steep steps that dive down about 75 feet and then take a turn, which is you're standing on that turn here, and go down to a spring. The wall you see there going off to the left, you'll see in another photo, encloses that spring. And then next to the spring is also a creek running down the side of the hill. Here is a picture of, from the bottom, the spring is in that semicircular place. The stonework is all the built part of this tiny, tiny, very private park, and the rest of it is wild down to the James River, just gradually going down the slope. Now, we sometimes went there, and I think this might have been the reason I was walking with my mother to the park that day. I just don't quite remember. We would go there to get water when our city of Richmond tap water turned brown and had to be boiled in the summer, which happened pretty often when the James River was kind of low. So we didn't go there very often. It was a little too far for me to go by myself. And when I was about 6, we moved away to another neighborhood. Not too far away, but too far for me to walk or ride my bike back to Wayside Spring. And I remember loving this place. I was so drawn to it. And I couldn't have told you why as a little girl. But the beautiful stonework, the hiddenness, the quietness, the water is so cold and fresh and clear. And once I graduated from high school, I left Richmond to go to college and did not go back for almost 30 years. And about 10 years or so after I had left Richmond, I had lived only on the East Coast in Virginia, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Massachusetts. And then I moved to Gallup, New Mexico. And I went there to work for the Navajo Nation. My office was in Window Rock, Arizona, which is the capital of the Navajo Nation. Now, I had never been to the southwestern United States before, and many of you may not have either. It is very different looking than the East Coast, wildly different looking. And for the first time in my life, I had a conscious understanding of the land as alive. And I don't mean that metaphorically, I mean it literally. It made sense to me, to all of my senses, that the Native American people there, the Navajo, the Zuni, and the Hopi, were all around me, that they experienced the land as alive. I got it. And maybe this was because the landscape and ecology were so different from what I was used to, that the energy and vitality of the land was just very apparent to me. Maybe it was because I was now an adult and a Unitarian Universalist and a consciously spiritual seeker. So maybe I was more attuned to the energies of that interdependent web of all existence that we live in, connected in a lively way to everything around us in the universe. I can't tell you why I experienced this shift. I just knew and know that the land was alive. I felt it in my feet, my head, my bones, my heart, literally. And here are a couple of the places that spoke so powerfully to me of the liveliness of this land. Up in the northwest corner of the Navajo Nation is Monument Valley, known to many people from the great Western films of the 50s and 60s. Many of them were filmed there. Towering monuments of red rock. And you can't see it in some of the daytime pictures, but the rock has many layers in it, including some that appear to be something like quartz, and so they glow at night, certain layers of the rock. But interspersed in the rock are shades of green and yellow and brown. Here's another view from Monument Valley. Someone at the early service said, yes, those are the mittens. I think when we give those kinds of names to these very alive places, I wonder if we're not trying to tame them somehow. But I kind of resisted all those names when I was there to the extent that I could. And this is my favorite place in the Navajo Nation. The slide might be a bit dark. Right in the middle of the Navajo Nation is a place called Canyon de Chelly, where three canyons sort of come together like a bird foot. And they are not very wide, because you're seeing one of them here, but they can be pretty deep. They get as deep as 800 to 1,000 feet. And that formation right at the front of the screen, it's kind of a freestanding double tower, is called Spider Rock. And because in the Navajo cosmology, this is where the Spider Woman goddess Spider Woman, she came down to give the Navajo people the gift of weaving, which is something that they do so beautifully. So from that time on, since living there on Navajo, I was alive to how alive the land was. Wherever I lived after that, and I lived lots of places after that. And then some years later, I was living in Texas and became drawn to the earth-centered path, to modern paganism. And then my sense of the land as living became even more clear and present to me. And that's the point at which the land truly became a focus of ritual and meditation and prayer. And then my awareness shifted yet a bit more to not only seeing the land as alive, but seeing the earth as sacred. Not only alive, but sacred and holy. Years later, after being gone from Richmond for almost 30 years, I returned there in 2001. I lived again on the south side of the James because we were still oppressed and I was not going to leave my people. Not in my old neighborhood. We still have to pay to get to the other side. One day, not long after my return, I had come to Richmond a few times over the years for brief periods, but not a long time. Now I was living there again. So I had one of those desires to walk or drive down memory lane. So I was driving around and going by my schools and houses where I had lived. So I was going to the house where we first lived, and I drove by the wayside spring, slammed on the brakes, parked my car. Yes, this place. I had forgotten this place. Went down those stairs to the spring. Oh, I was so glad it was all still there, still flowing, still sweet. And then I knew why I had loved this place as a little girl. I had recognized at the age of 4, as children so often do, that this was a sacred place, a living place. And so often, for so many people, springs and wells around the world are often experienced as sacred places. So for the next 4 years, while living in Richmond, each May 1st, I went to the wayside spring and swept the stairs from top to bottom, cleared away the winter debris from the spring, planted native plants and wildflowers, and left cut flowers to honor the spirit of the place. May 1st, or Beltane, as it is known to pagans, is a holiday perhaps better known for jumping over bonfires and dancing around maypoles, which are wonderful things to do. However, in the Celtic tradition, Beltane is also the time for visiting sacred wells and springs, for cleaning them and leaving offerings of flowers or other beautiful things. And after that first year there, I was always joined by friends. And one year, well, in theory, you're supposed to go out on Beltane to do this at dawn, but I am not a morning pagan. As I am not a morning person. And so we were there around 8 o'clock. It was a Saturday, so that was plenty early enough. And we encountered a man who must live in the neighborhood. He was out walking his dog. And seeing us in our robes and garlands with our brooms and our plants and our flowers, he knew immediately what we were doing and why. And in the accent of his native Ireland, he wished us a happy May Day, because, of course, throughout Scotland and Ireland, many of these pagan traditions still very much live on, and not necessarily with an overtly religious conscious connotation, but very much still woven into the people's lives. So that was very beautiful, and it was lovely to feel his appreciation, because his appreciation was deep and real. And when I am in Richmond, I am going tomorrow, and while I was still living there, I often did go and do go to the wayside spring to meditate, reflect, and pray, and it is really a place of soul spirit for me. So that is my own story of becoming aware of and awake to the sacredness and aliveness of the earth. Anthropologist Richard Nelson, I think, expresses this understanding very well when he writes about the relationship between humans and place. He says, "I've often thought of the forest as a living cathedral, but this might diminish what it truly is. If I have understood Native American teachings, the forest is not merely an expression or representation of sacredness, nor a place to invoke the sacred. The forest is sacredness itself. Nature is not merely created by God. Nature is God. Whoever moves within the forest can partake directly of sacredness, experience sacredness with his entire body, breathe sacredness and contain it within himself, drink the sacred water as a living communion, bury his feet in sacredness, touch the living branch and feel the sacredness, open his eyes and witness the burning beauty of sacredness." So what is meant by the concept of sacred in reference to a place? Clearly, it's not just saying, well, here is a place of beauty that we appreciate and enjoy. No, it is saying much more. Sacred means worthy of spiritual veneration and entitled to reverence and respect. In the presence of a place that is worthy of veneration, we feel a sense of wonder, awe, and reverence going far beyond simple enjoyment of beauty and appreciation for that. A sacred place is numinous, meaning filled with a sense of the holy presence. This does not necessarily mean something like a god. It can often mean what the Romans termed a genius loci, which is that distinctive atmosphere or pervading spirit of a place. Archaeologist Christopher Tilley writes, "A sacred landscape is not simply a backdrop for action, but rather a place filled with names, associations, and memories that link together everything present there. Humans become linked to the rocks, trees, animals, rivers, mountains, and these bonds guide future interaction with that place." Adrian Ivakiv, professor of environmental studies at the University of Vermont, writes, "Sacred places are physical and geographic anchor points for our psychic and cultural imaginings, the stories we tell about ourselves, the world, and the relations between them." So you hear that sacred places are places of connection and relationship with the sacred, with the living and non-living beings of a place, and with other humans who may have been present there before, are there now, or are yet to come. Sacred places are where we can imagine and tell important stories about all of these relationships. Sacred places are also places that we need. We need what is mysterious and unfathomable in our lives. We also need sacred places for comfort, solace, and healing. Here's Unitarian Henry David Thoreau writing in Walden. "We need the tonic of wildness. At the same time that we are earnest to explore and learn all things, we require that all things be mysterious and unexplorable, that land and sea be indefinitely wild, unsurveyed and unfathomed by us, because unfathomable. We can never have enough of nature." And finally, these words, "The best remedy for those who are afraid, lonely, or unhappy is to go outside, somewhere where they can be quite alone with the heavens, nature, and God. Because only then does one feel that all is as it should be, and that God wishes people to be happy amidst the simple beauty of nature. As long as this exists, and it certainly always will, I know that there will always be comfort for every sorrow, whatever the circumstances may be. And I firmly believe that nature does bring solace in all troubles." That is Anne Frank. As I was looking at pictures of sacred places, and of course, you could watch pictures of sacred places for days on end and barely scratch the surface of what is sacred on this earth, so I had to choose. And as I looked at them, it seemed to me that there are three kinds of sacred place. There are those sacred places that are constructed by humans intentionally to be sacred. There are those sacred places that are a mix of human construction and nature. And there are those sacred places that are natural only. And that's mostly what I have been talking about, that last category. But the others are certainly real and worth experiencing. They, too, evoke wonder, awe, and reverence. They, too, can be places of relationship, mystery, and healing. And I want to show you some of these places. I hope sort of not in the spirit of a travelogue. I have been to some of them, but not all of them. And as I change the slides, if you can, perhaps try to enter into those places as sacred places. This is part of the Angkor Wat temple complex, a Buddhist temple in Cambodia. It is very, very large, covering many, many acres, and is still an active and living religious place with monks who live there. This is the Kaaba, which is at the center of Mecca, the most sacred city for Muslim people in Saudi Arabia. And as with so many sacred places, there are layers of time here. At the front left corner of the Kaaba, which is a structure that has some sacred things in it, it's a square building, often covered with this cloth. At the front corner, you can't see it, is something called the Black Stone. And it is a stone that was worshipped by the people of the area long, long before Islam came to be. And so, as with so many sacred places, there's been an adding on, an accumulation of sacred structures. This is the also very large Meenakshi Temple in Madurai, India. It is a Hindu temple. These are not my pictures, but I went there when I was in seminary. We were required to take a cross-cultural trip, and the year that I went, we went to India. And this complex is huge. This is just the central courtyard where there is water, but the buildings go on and about quite a distance. And the structure is surrounded by four towers that you see here. The tallest one is probably almost 20 stories tall. And they are very, very, very much alive. We're going to kind of focus in. They are covered with layers of figures and humans and devas and gods and goddesses painted in bright colors that almost have a sense of movement. We'll go in even closer. And most of these figures are slightly larger for the humans, slightly larger than life. And so when you look at these towers, they almost seem to vibrate with sacred energy. And inside, there are places in the temple where it is very dark. There are hundreds of specific sites for making offerings to different gods. There are processions coming through, statues of gods being borne on the shoulders of worshipers. And throughout this temple, the ceilings and sometimes the walls and the floors are painted these vibrant colors with mandalas and pictures of important gods, goddesses, and people, and carving everywhere. It is amazing. And very much with these mandalas, again, that sense of living sacredness. This is the Golden Temple in Amritsar, India, northern India. This is the most sacred temple for people of the Sikh religious tradition, which originated in India. This is a Tibetan Buddhist monastery and temple in the Himalayas. In Tibet. This is a mosque, a Muslim mosque in Timbuktu in Mali in Africa. It is built of what I would call rammed earth or adobe with wooden structural supports. This is the Eldridge Street Synagogue, built at the late 19th century in New York City. Its interior, everything in it was designed uniquely for its space, everything. The chandeliers, the Ark of the Covenant, everything. And at many of the places that I was looking at that had been built by humans for sacredness, were old and often, as I said before, built in places that had been sacred spaces, sacred places for centuries, if not thousands of years. But I did find some structures that are newer, and this is one of them, built in 2006. This is the Malacca Straits Mosque in Malaysia. And as I looked for newer expressions of sacred construction, I found that the Muslim people, maybe more than anyone else, have opened up their hearts and their treasure to letting their architects' imaginations go very wild and free. At higher tide, this building, the water comes right up to the bottom of that railing so that the mosque appears to be floating on water. And I ask you, perhaps in the coming days, to think about how is this building and this land alive and sacred for you? How do you experience it that way? Maybe that might be something you might want to deepen and live in and make more rich. Then there are sacred places that are a mix of human and natural construction. We're going to look at a few of those. This is a Clutie Well in Scotland. And all over Scotland and Ireland, you will find Clutie Wells. Clutie is Gaelic for clout or cloth. And so people will go to a sacred spring, which here is in the middle there, coming out of the ground. And the tradition was to tie little pieces of cloth to the branches or tie them to trees or rocks around the sacred well as a prayer for healing. And more in modern times, it's not simply pieces of cloth, but entire articles of clothing or even other items that people bring to the wells for healing for those people, in gratitude. So this has been going on for thousands of years and very much is still alive as a practice. Here is an area in Turkey called Cappadocia, and these are some kind of volcanic formation. That's pretty much the end of my geology to understand them. And over the centuries, especially since the coming of Christianity, they have been hollowed out to serve as monasteries, churches, and also living spaces for people. Some of them go underground. You can see the doorways and the windows there. This is the famed in song and poetry, the rose-red city of Petra in Jordan, where people hollowed out. I am not sure that people live there on an ongoing basis, but it was certainly at least perhaps a ceremonial or government site with these elaborate frontages of buildings built into the living rock. And finally, as I've already spoken of, there are sacred places that are natural only. And anthropologist Angelus Arian says, many of the peoples of the world recognize that there are four places in nature where you can find deep peace and remember who you really are. One is in the deep woods, one is in the desert, one in the mountains, and one near the ocean. Here are some of the deepest of the deep woods. You can see the person there in the right for scale. This is the redwood forest of Northern California. The great desert of the Sahara. Ayers Rock in Australia, this formation standing alone, coming out of a plain, sacred to Aboriginal people for thousands of years. This is Hawaii. Please take a moment now to think of a place to bring to your mind's eye, a place that is sacred to you, where you feel awe, reverence, mystery, and healing. Feel your gratitude for that place. In the coming weeks, I invite you to visit a sacred place. It could be one you have made in your own house, your own backyard. If you do not have a place that you might consider to be sacred, I urge you to, one that is near to you, I urge you to identify one. It might be here on your beautiful land, here in this beautiful building. And experience yourself as standing on holy ground. How do you do that when you're in your sacred place? I end with these words of Joseph Campbell. You must have a place or a certain hour of the day where you do not know what is in the morning paper. A place where you can simply experience and bring forth what you are or might be. At first, you might think nothing is happening, but if you have a sacred place and go there often, something will happen. Where to begin? The word sacred evokes a feeling of something holy, serene, worthy of reverence. What makes your place a sacred place is when you prepare yourself to stand on holy ground. So may you prepare, so may it be for you. Blessed be.